So welcome everybody. Thank you very much for coming on the show. We have some very interesting things to discuss today. Difficult subjects, and in some way tragic subjects, certainly for the people who, Chas v'Shalom, are involved in these kind of shilas, but fascinating halachic topics nevertheless, because what I want to do is take what we learned last week, which was about fetal reduction, and take it forward to the next stage, which is the issue of conjoined twins. Many of the questions that we talked about last week will come back this week, but we'll see them applied in a slightly different way. And we'll see some of the sources we saw last week, and we'll develop them in other directions. But the issue of conjoined twins is a much older issue, and we'll see a much more common issue. So just let's recap on what we saw last week. On the issue of fetal reductions, we saw that the fetus, definitely everybody agrees, has to be killed, certainly may be killed. Whether it has to be killed is an interesting question, to save the life of the mother. As to whether a fetus can be killed to save the life of another fetus, we discussed that at great length last week. Do we say that the fetus is somehow less alive than the mother and therefore less alive than other fetuses or not? Do we say that the fetus is a roideth? We'll explore all of this today, that it pursues in some way the other fetuses. Applying all of these questions to conjoined twins will give us a different perspective, and that's what I hope to develop today. So conjoined twins are they used to be called Siamese twins for reasons that will be obvious in a minute. But conjoined twins are a natural phenomenon. They're very rare. They only happen in one in every 80, 90, 100,000 cases. But they've been recorded from antiquity. Almost half of all conjoined twins are stillborn, so they never survive at all. An additional third die within the first 24 hours. But of those that survive, for some reason which we don't really know, most are female. It's relatively rare to have male conjoined twins. But the chances of you getting an adult pair of conjoined twins are actually very small. As we'll see, nevertheless, they figure in the writings of Chazal in some fascinating ways. Now, there are two theories about how conjoined twins come about. The main theory is that a single fertilized egg, which will be an identical twin, starts to separate but doesn't fully separate and ends up connected together in one of a number of different ways. There is a theory that two separate eggs could fuse in some way, but that's much less accepted, and therefore it turns out that conjoined twins are pretty much always the same sex. They're always both boys or both girls. How are they conjoined? So I'll share the sheet with you just for a second, because there are some interesting issues that I've actually summarized on the sheet. So let me just share the sheet with you on the screen there. Hopefully you can see that. Maybe you can't see that yet. Just one second. We're having a technically challenging day today. So let's just put that on there. One second. Okay. Okay, fine. Can you now see my shared screen? Hopefully you can. Yes, a thumbs up from someone? Good, a nod. So I brought you here a picture of the most famous conjoined twins, which gave the name Siamese twins. These twins are a pair of two men called Eng and Chang. They came originally from Siam, which is now called Thailand, and they were brought over with Barnum Circus, actually, to America, and they lived most of their life in America. They took the name Bunker, and they married two girls. They married Sally, and the other girl was called, just remember her name here, Adelaide, Sally and Adelaide, who married the two. They were actually identical twins, but they were not conjoined. I don't think there's ever been a case of two conjoined twins marrying two conjoined twins. But they married these British twins, and they lived together in Minnesota. They actually had many, many children from that marriage. There were 11 children that actually survived, and there are nearly 1,500 living descendants of those twins alive today. We'll talk about how they managed to do all of that. They lived a long life, and they gave the name to Siamese twins. You can see from the photograph that they were only mildly connected. They were only connected at the sternum, at the top of their chest there. Otherwise, they were two entirely separate people, which explains how they managed to marry separate women and have separate families. They had between them, as I said, 11 living children. But conjoined twins can be conjoined in all sorts of different ways. They can be joined at the chest, which is the most common situation, which where they share the liver. That was the case with the bunkers. They can be joined at the top of the chest and share the heart. They can be joined much lower down, where they're usually completely separate. They can be parasitic, which we'll see in a minute is an important idea, where there's one main twin and the other one is clearly a less formed parasite, if you like, living off the other twin that could never survive on its own. And they, of course, can be conjoined at the head, which is itself fascinating because you can have conjoined twins who share part of their brain who can actually see through each other's eyes and feel through each other's limbs, which is a remarkable, remarkable phenomenon. And we'll see soon, because the halacha suggests and discusses all of these cases, but as I said before, they are basically natural, they're natural occurrences. There are many examples in antiquity of conjoined twins being referred to. There's quite a famous case which is quoted a lot by the Mefarshim, a case which is brought by the Islamic scholar Ibn Sina. He talks about two women, A and B, who were joined together. And A wanted to get married, and B objected, because B said, I'm not prepared for your husband to see me with in a situation which is immodest. And therefore she objected and said, I don't agree to us getting married. The case went to court. The judge said to B, who was objecting, stand up and come before the court. And of course B couldn't, because B was a parasitic twin. And then he said to A, you stand up and come before the court. And A, of course, could, and dragged B with her. And the judge, this was non-Jewish court, the judge there said, I see from this that A is the main person and B is simply a parasite, and I rule that you can get married. She did get married to the objection of B. B was so mortified at this particular situation that she died shortly after the marriage from shame. And of course, twin A that was connected to her died very shortly thereafter, because you cannot have a dead twin attached to you. The toxins that come out very quickly killed twin A as well. So you see from that story, whether it's an accurate story or not, that these questions are there already from ancient times. We'll see in the Gemara as well, and they very rarely have easy solutions and very rarely have happy endings. Separating conjoined twins, of course, is a modern phenomenon. Because until recently, the medical technology has not been available to separate the twins. But now it is. And not always. Obviously, twins which are fused at the brain cannot be separated. But the bunkers, the Siamese twins that were in the 1800s, could easily have been separated now with medical technology and lived separate lives. And you can go online and find any number of cases of twins who have been separated, in many cases successfully. So what are the halachic issues involved? So, obviously, the cases that we're dealing with today are cases where they have not been separated. There are many halakhic issues involved. One of the most critical, which we'll be dealing with today, is what if, in order to separate the twins, you must kill one of the twins? And this, of course, was the famous case in 1977, which we're going to talk about, which Rav Moshe Feinstein adjudicated on. But sometimes, in order to separate them, one will always die. The parasitic twin will die. What is the halakhic status there? But let's assume that you don't separate them. There are all sorts of fascinating questions. For example, if may they marry? Let's say you have twin girls. Are they allowed to get married? Can they marry one man? Can they marry two men? These are not new questions. If a man marries conjoined twins, is he marrying two sisters? Is there a halachic prohibition to marry these two sisters, because obviously, you know, they are clearly twins? Is there an adulterous relationship going on here? Is there an incestuous relationship, as I said before? Is he marrying two sisters, like I mentioned before? Even if that's not the case, is this a case where a person has two wives, which of course one is not allowed to marry? Do both sisters have to agree to the marriage? Do they both have to accept Kiddushin? Does he have to stand under the chuppah and say, Hariat Mekudeshet Li, Vahariat Mekudeshet Li, twice, one to each of them? What if one of them objects? Is that then a case of rape to the one who has objected to the marriage? Does it make a difference if they have one body, two bodies? There's a fascinating case that I put a note with on, you can go online and see a video of a pair of conjoined twins in North America, in Minnesota, I think they are, where there's one body and two heads, and they function, and they drive a car, and they get around, and they go to work. What difference do those differences of conjoining make? What if it's twin brothers, like the case of the Bunkers? Is one sleeping with the other one's wife? Is it a sister-in-law issue? What about if one just touches his wife? Is the other one? And halakhically, is there ever a permitted marriage scenario? Because in order to have an intimate relationship, there's always going to be somebody else there. There's always going to be the other conjoined twin. And could that ever be permitted? Or is that automatically a prohibition of a lack of tzniut that one of them is having a relationship with the other twin, obviously always present? Clearly today, if they can be divided, these questions will be removed to a large degree, but in the old days when they couldn't, these were very present. There are any number of other shilas. For example, let me give you four examples of questions which have come up in the postgame. Let's say one of the twin boys, let's say, and they have an older brother that dies, and they have to do chalitza or yibum. They have to marry the older brother's wife. Which one does it? The one on the left or the one on the right? Now, by the way, the one on the left is usually stronger. It's not clear why medically the one on the left is stronger, but the one on the left is usually stronger. What about this case? If you give Mishloach Manas on Purim, I'm not making this up, this is a real Shaila. If you give Mishloach Manas on Purim, you have to give to two people. What if you give to a conjoined twin? Does that count as two people, or is that giving to one people? What about Minyan? If a conjoined twin comes to a Minyan, do you have two men there, or do you have one man there? And again, does it depend on what level of conjoining is there? This is not a theoretical question. This could be a real question. Do you count two for a minion, one for a minion? Do they get a double portion of inheritance or not? We'll see that comes up in Tosfos very shortly. So with all that by way of introduction, and again, these are not theoretical. These are real shilas because conjoined twins have come up. Let's talk about the 1977 case. This is basically how the case played out. In September 1977, on September the 15th, a pair of conjoined twin girls was born to a Jewish family in Lakewood. The family was an Orthodox family. The parents were involved in Jewish education. And it was clear that if something wasn't done, then both of these twins would die. They were flown, they were helicoptered to the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Some of you may remember this case. I was too young to remember this case. But they were flown to the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. They shared a number of internal organs, particularly the heart. What you had here, and this is very important for the halachic analysis, a heart normally has four chambers. This pair of conjoined twins had a six-chambered heart. And the theory was that there was one fully formed heart of baby B and one stunted heart of baby A, which only had two chambers. But they were fused into a six-chambered heart, and the twins shared them between each other. It was clear that if they both stayed conjoined, they would both die. But it was also clear, in order to separate them, the only way to separate them was to sacrifice one of them to save the other. And the only one which could sensibly be sacrificed was twin A, baby A, because baby A was already severely ill with circulatory problems and only had this two-chambered heart. So the question came up, are we allowed to kill directly baby A? And remember, this is not a fetus. These were two little girls who were awake, responsive, have their own personalities, who lived in the hospital for about a month, okay, to whom the nurses and doctors became quite connected and attached. Are you allowed to actively kill baby A in order to save baby B? Now, the doctor in this case was a doctor called Dr. Everett Koop, who later became the Surgeon General of America. He was a very religious man himself. He was a Presbyterian who had his own very strong religious beliefs. He prayed every day, and he said he was unable to resolve that ethical dilemma. Many of the nurses and doctors in the hospital were Catholics, and they went to their own advisors. But the family, which was, of course, a religious Orthodox Jewish family, they went to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who lived in Yerushalayim, was approached and asked to Paskin, are we allowed to kill baby A in order to save baby B? Dr. Koop actually said to his team, who were very unhappy about the whole situation, and by the way, many of the Catholics involved pulled out of the team because they said, we're not going to be responsible for the act of killing of a child. Dr. Koop, quote, said, the ethics and morals involved in this decision are too complex for me, I believe they are too complex for you as well, he said to his team. Therefore, I referred this to an old rabbi on the Lower East Side of New York. He is a great scholar, a saintly individual, and he knows how to answer such questions. When he tells me, I too will know. That quote was given by Rav Moshe Tendler, who is Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law, who was deeply involved in this particular case. What basically happened is Rav Moshe Feinstein moved in with his son-in-law and daughter, the Tendlers, and together they discussed this case all the way through the Chag, all the way through Sukkot, and on Motzei Sukkot, on October the 6th, Rav Moshe Feinstein gave a psak. It was permitted to kill baby A in order to save baby B. And that is what they did. They performed an operation. There were a lot of expected complications, but the complications actually were not as bad as they thought. They severed the bloodstream coming through to baby A. They put the heart wholly within baby B, the six-chambered heart, and baby A was immediately killed. The problem that we have, looking back on this nearly 40 years later, is Rav Moshe never gave his reasoning and never wrote this up, and this tshuva, this responsa, was never published in the Igros Moshe. And therefore, we rely upon the people who learned with him, specifically Rav Moshe Tendler and Rav J. David Bleich, to explain to us what Rav Moshe's reasoning was. The problem we're going to see is both of these contemporary poskim, Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Bleich, disagree about why Rav Moshe permitted it. And we're going to look at both of their reasonings. First of all, Rav Tendler's reasoning. Second of all, Rabbi Bleich's reasoning. And we're going to see why they think Rav Moshe Feinstein actually permitted the sacrifice of baby A to save baby B. And we'll see why each disagrees with the other. Okay, so we can see already why this is going to be a very interesting analysis. So let's have a look at the sheet. The first question we need to ask is, are we dealing here with one person or two? Because obviously, if this is one baby, if we can classify this as one individual, then there's no shaila, there's no question. Of course you can amputate part of one individual to save the rest of the individual. It's no different from cutting off an arm, cutting off a leg. You can cut off this piece of extra flesh and save the life of baby B, if they are one person. If they are two people, obviously we have to work out what to do. So is a conjoined twin one or two people? So have a look with me at the Gemara in Menachos. This Gemara in Menachos is one of the most detailed analyses from the ancient world of conjoined twins. Let's have a look at it together. Fascinating. Number one. Boimine Plimo Rebbe. Plimo asked Rebbe. Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, living in Israel in the 2nd century, was approached by one of his colleagues, Plimo, who asked him the following. Mi sheyesh lo shnei roshim, a boy that has two heads. Be'eze mehem manich tfilin. Which head does he put tfilin on? The left head or the right head? Okay. Amalei, Rebbe responded to him, you have two options. Or kum gali, or get out and go into exile, or kibbel alecha shamta, or I'm going to put you in cherem. Why? Rashi explained, because you're asking me stupid questions. You're asking me ridiculous questions. You're making fun of me. What do you mean if a baby has two heads, which head does he put tefillin on? By the way, why can't he just put tefillin on both heads? What's the problem? Let him put tefillin on both heads, just to be on the safe side. The problem is, you can't, there's a prohibition in the Torah of Baal Tosef. The Torah says to wear one set of tefillin, you can't wear two sets of tefillin, okay? Of course, the problem could be solved if one head wore Rashi's tefillin and one head wore Rebbeinu Tam's tefillin. That would actually resolve the problem, okay? But anyway, he threw him out of the Bet Midrash and said to him, you're asking me ridiculous questions, I'm not answering that question. What happened right then? Says the Gemara, Adahachi Asahuhu Gavra, a man ran into the Bet Midrash, and he said to the rabbis, it's Yolid Li Yenuka de Islay Trey Rashi. My wife has given birth to a baby boy who had two heads. A real scenario. By the way, if you're interested in Roman history, at the same time as this episode, Cassius Dio, who was a Roman historian at the time, reports a case of a two-headed baby being born in the Roman Empire and the discussions of how that works, and there are some unfortunate that want to suggest this is the same baby. Whatever. But a two-headed baby was born. Kama ba'inan lemeisiv lekohen. How much money do I need to give to the Kohen? I need to do Pidyon Haben. Is it 5 shkalim? Or is it 10 shkalim? How much do I have to give? Asa Hahu Saba, one of the elder colleagues in the Bet Midrash, whether that's Eliyahu Anovi, someone else, not for now, said to him, Chayev liten lo yud slan. You have to give 10 shekalim. Double. Why? Debegugolet talia rachmana. Because the Torah says it depends on the number of heads, and here you have two heads. This may be a case where two heads are not better than one, okay? But this baby has two heads, and you're therefore obligated to pay 10 shekalim. Okay, so now I ask you, according to this Gemara, is a conjoined twin one person or two people? What does it sound like? Sounds a bit like two people, right? Sounds a bit like two people. On the other hand, if it was really two people, then why is there even a question about the tefillin? If you really have two boys here, then of course they both have to wear tefillin. There's two different people here. Only if there's one person, is there a question which head do you put the tefillin on? So it's not at all clear from this Gemara whether the conclusion is that they are one or the conclusion is that they are two. It could go in either direction. Tysfus jump in immediately and give a very fascinating midrash. This is going to get a slightly weird. I warn you in advance. These days one has to give trigger warnings for people when you're about to say something that's slightly strange. So consider this to be a trigger warning that there's a slightly strange midrash coming up. Looking Tysfus in number two. Tysfus says, "Ba'olam hazeh leika." He says, "I don't think there's any such thing as a baby with two heads in this world." Well, that's not the case. But let's carry on Tosfos nevertheless. Aval yesh v'midrash, but I'm going to give you a midrash. Ashmadai. Who is Ashmadai? Ashmadai is the midrashic head of the demon underworld. Ashmadai hotzi mitachat karcha adam echad sheyesh lo shnei roshim. Ashmadai, the head of the demons, brought a man up with two heads, lifnei Shlomo HaMelech, and he brought him before Shlomo HaMelech. V'nasa isha, this two-headed man, demon man, married a wife with one head, okay? For Hoyled Banim, says Tosfos, and they had a family. Kiyotze bo b'shnei roshim, some of the kids had two heads like him. Or kiyotze b'ishko b'rosh echam, some of the kids had one head like the wife, okay? Or kishibau lachloik b'nichsei avihem, and when they came to divide up the inheritance, when daddy demon died, okay? Misha yesh lo shnei roshim shal shnei chalakim. The person, one of the boys with two heads, demanded double the inheritance. Uvar le din lifnei Shlomo, and they came to Shlomo for judgment. Okay, now what exactly? This kind of links in with our shirim on inheritance. Who gets a double portion? Who gets a single portion? So here Tosfos is saying this double-headed son of a demon is demanding two portions in the inheritance because he says I'm two people, not one. Now Tosfos doesn't tell us what happens. Actually, the end of this midrash, which is very frustrating, but other people do, and I'm not going to read through number three, but the Ben Yehoyada quotes, who is the Ben Ishchai, the Chidah, who quotes the end of that midrash and says, this is what Shlomo HaMelech did. He brought boiling water, and he poured it over one of the heads of the twins, and he wanted to see if the other one felt the pain. And since the other one did feel the pain, said Shlomo HaMelech, clearly you are one twin, he said. You are not two people, you are one person. Fascinatingly, what's this Medrash asking? Do they have a joint nervous system? Do they share aspects of their brain and nervous system or not? Says Shlomo HaMelech, if you do, then I'm going to judge you as being one person. Okay, the Ben Ish Chai says, could be that this was actually a mystical test, not a physical test. They poured wine on, they poured water on. I'm going to leave you to look at this in your own time. But what seems to be coming out of this midrashic idea, if we can even learn from a midrash, don't forget that midrashim are there to learn philosophical rather than halachic ideas, but it sounds from this midrash that you're coming out with the idea that certainly someone who shares sensation may be one, not two people. By the way, there is a midrash that you may also know about Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve being created as two conjoined bodies, male and female. And it says, male and female, God created them. And one of the midrashim there says that they were created as a conjoined twin. Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, one of the poskim in the early 18th century, says, you see from here that conjoined twins are two people. Because Adam and Chava are clearly two people, not one person. And, you know, whether that's, again, midrashically, that's fascinating, but it may not be halachically relevant, because, again, we've seen in Shirim in the past, one cannot normally learn halachic conclusions from a midrash. Also, don't forget, Adam and Chava are a male and female, and therefore may not be comparable in any case to conjoined twins. Okay. Let's go on a little bit, and then we'll get back into Rav Moshe Feinstein's sack in a couple of minutes. Have a look here on page 4. What's going on here on page four obviously will make a difference to, as I said before, what is the extent of the joining? Are they two bodies? Are they two heads with one body? Are they joined at the chest? Do they share sensations? Do they share pain? We saw that from the Midrash, that they share pain. There may be one person, etc. Who is this a picture of here? This interesting looking old picture is a picture of the Colorado twins. Now, I'd never heard of half of this. I did a lot of research for this chair this week. Who are the Colorado twins? The Colorado twins are Lazarus and Batista Colorado. They lived in Italy in the mid-1600s. And as you can see from this contemporaneous picture, one of them was fully formed, and one of them was malformed, one of them was a parasitic twin. Have a look at this description of the Colorado twins in number four. In Rav Yisrael Chagiz, who lived in Eretz Yisrael and was also from Italy, describes these twins. Have a look at this. It's fascinating. Number four. Zachruni, he says, I remember, Shiraiti bebedinas Italia, when I saw once in Italy, Goy Echad, I saw a non-Jewish fellow, Keben Chafhei, he was about 25 years old, Chafhei Shanim, Shinoila Dovuk im Ta'umo ad Hatabur. He was conjoined with his twin brother to the navel. Chazei Kenegit Chazei, chest against chest. Vashan Lidbaku, and that's where they were joined together, he says. For Hu Hayaholech Vashalem, the one twin walked around whole, Keshar B'nei Adam, like a regular person. The Rosh HaKatan, but the head of the second twin, Mutal Etzad Echad, was twisted to one side. The Ragla Tluyis Umagiyas Ad Arkubasav Shelagodol, and the legs hung down, the legs of the second twin were obviously not functional legs, they just hung down to the knees of the main twin. The Loi Hayabor HaGashaklal, he couldn't feel those legs at all. Eleke Eva Shinitvatl Chushe, it's like a paralyzed limb. And they lived like this for many years. By the way, in parentheses, I'll tell you an interesting story. Lazarus, the healthy twin, actually hit somebody and killed them in a fight. And he was, in the Italian courts, said he was liable to the death penalty. The other twin, the parasitic twin, pleaded in front of the court. You can't make this stuff up, it's true. Pleaded in front of the court that it was not fair to carry out the death penalty on the twin that killed the guy because he was attached to him and he'd get killed as well. And the court actually accepted that ruling and said, fair enough, we're not going to kill you. Anyway, that's a side issue. So look at the halachic question here. Nistakpu ha-horgomai, what if you killed, you'll see why this is so critical for the 1977 case. What if you killed the parasitic twin? Is that murder? Asked Rav Yisrael Chagiz. And he says the following. Tzarich loimai, you have to answer the following. Shetivuro davuk im shelter umo, since their stomachs are joined together, the hachavei akavei shelachiv sholeach dam derech shiryon lachavei shelo, and they share a liver. So it's a really interesting medical analysis from 400-300 years ago. They share a liver. Umisham nizon, from there the parasitic twin is fed kama b'mei imo, just like a fetus, just like a fetus being fed by the mother through a placenta, this parasitic twin is being fed by the healthy brother. The eshel adonah kedim goses. And therefore, I'm going to give this parasitic twin a halachic status of alive, but a goses. What is a goses? A goses is someone who is on the verge of death. They are no longer capable of long-term life. And therefore, interestingly, Rav Yisrael Chagiz says that this parasitic twin is alive, and therefore you cannot kill it, but it's not alive in the long term. It's a bit like a fetus, in the sense compared to its parasitic brother. And interestingly, rather tragically, at the end he says, "Va'ala katan omer," on the parasitic twin you can say, "Baruch dayan ha'emes," nevach. While it's still alive, you can say, "Baruch dayan ha'emes, ki roi goitesim lemisa," because most people in that state will eventually die. But what you have here is an example from 400 years ago of a parasitic twin where the halachic psak really was, clearly, that it would be murder to kill the other parasitic twin. Fine. Let's get back to Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe Paskin that you were able to kill baby A to save baby B, and that is what they did. First question, was there one child or two? So very clearly it was ruled at the very beginning of this deliberation that there were clearly two children here. Even though they shared a liver and they shared a heart, they have completely independent brains, completely independent nervous systems. They were considered by Rav Moshe Feinstein to be two people from the start. Remember that midrashic test of the shared nervous system from Shlomo HaMelech. So Rav Moshe says, I'm dealing here with two people, therefore you can't talk about amputation. It's clearly killing one to save the other. That's the first question. The second question is, was there a dominant twin? Yes, clearly this was a case of a parasitic twin. Baby B was much healthier. Rav Moshe asked the doctor here, is it possible that we could give the heart to baby A? Or can the heart only be given to baby B? And the doctor replied unequivocally that there's no way that baby A could maintain this heart. It wouldn't survive with this heart. The only baby which could survive with the heart was baby B. Now, that doesn't mean that baby B owned the heart, necessarily, and Rabbi Blythe talks about that, but it does mean that only baby B could survive with the heart. Rav Moshe asked that question. So what was the reason for his psak? As I said, Rav Moshe gave a psak that they killed baby A to save baby B. So let me first look at Rav Moshe Tendler's analysis. Rav Moshe Tendler said, basically, that baby A was able to be killed because it was less alive than baby B. And there was a roides factor here as well, which we'll see right now. Let's have a look at some of these sources. Some of them we saw last week, some of them we'll develop more together. Okay, so let's get into the halakhic analysis now. Source number 5. Ha'isha shahai makshaleded, we saw this last week, a woman who is having terrible difficulty giving birth. Mechatchin et havlad b'me'aha, we are allowed, maybe even obligated, I'm not getting into that discussion now. What if the mother said, I want my baby to live and I want to die? Not getting into that now. We cut up the baby in the womb. U'moitzim oto eivarim eirav, eivarim, we remove that baby, we kill the baby to save the mother. Mitnei shechayeha koidnim lechayav. Her life comes before the baby's life. Yatsa ruba, once the baby emerges, and we talked about this last word, weak, it emerges half, either the majority of the head, the majority of the body in a breach. Ein noigimba, we may not then kill the baby. She'ein dochin nefesh mitpin nefesh. Because we can't set off one life before another life. While the baby is a fetus, we may set off its life to save the mother. When the baby is now born, we may not do that. Now, why can't you set off one life against another? We saw this last week, but let's look at it again. Number 6. Roseach gufi menalon. How do we know that we may not kill to save others? Svarahu says the Gemara, it is a logical derivation. Gemara in Yuma, quite famous. Tahuda asle kamid rabba. A man came before rabba. Amalin, he said to him, Amalin maridura, what if the head of the town, the mayor of the town, said to me, Katle leplani, kill this other man, the Eloi, and if not, Katlina lach, I will kill you. So Rabbah responded, Amale, he said, Niktalech, you must die, the lo tiktol, you may not kill to save your life. My chaz is the damadidach, sumak tfei. Why do you think your blood is redder or sweeter than the others? Dilma damadahahu gavra sumak tfei. Maybe the blood of the other one is redder than yours. You can't value life. That's a fundamental halachic imperative. No life is worth more than another life. Look at Rav Moshe, look at Rav Shlomo Zalman. We never saw this last week, but a beautiful source. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, number 7, Kahein shel chayim, when it comes to life, ein lanu shum knei mida, we do not have any intellectual ability, kama limdod et yokram v'chashivutam, how to weigh one life against another, afilu loy b'torah mitzvah, even when it comes to Torah and mitzvah. You can't make value judgments on human life. Shehari mechalenin et haShabbos. We will break Shabbos actively and willingly. Gam al hazakin chola, even for a very sick, very elderly person. Mukad shchin, who is in terrible pain. Afal pi shehu cheresh, even if they are deaf, God forbid, v'shoiter, and they have no ability to think. Gamushote gamor, even though they're not capable of intellectual thought, they are completely, at the end, if you like, of any meaningful life as we would know it. That ain't yochel asod shum mitzvah, even if they can't do a single mitzvah. The chayav hem rak lemasa the sable godel al mishpatoi. He's obviously being the most extreme case. Even if the life of, God forbid, the life of this elderly person is a terrible burden on the family, the gorim lahem bittel Torah mitzvahs, and it's causing the family to be distracted and not be able to do other mitzvahs than looking after them. The noisiv mitzaram godel, and it's adding to the terrible emotional pain of the family. Afilu hachi mitzvah begdoli Yisrael hishtadela asog ba'atzalato lachal elavas Shabbos. Nevertheless, even the greatest people in the Jewish people, the biggest rabbis in the world, will jump in to break Shabbos in order to save that person. You cannot weigh life against other life. Contrast that, by the way, there was a conjoined twin case in England in the year 2000. It went to the Court of Appeal as to whether you could kill the parasitic twin. They also permitted killing the parasitic twin, but for very different reasons. I brought you the reasoning of the judge here. He said that the parasitic twin, who had no heart, who had no lungs, quote, her harsh life would only worsen as low level of oxygen in her blood further destroyed her brain. Killing Mary, the parasitic twin in that case, by stopping delivery of Jodie's blood would be an act of euthanasia, like withdrawing food and water from a terminally ill patient. If they stay together, the few months of Mary's life would be hurtful and mean nothing to her, said the judge. Therefore, you can kill the parasitic twin because her white life is worth less intrinsically. Now, the halacha will not accept that argument, very clearly. Life is never set off against life. Okay, good. So then why is a fetus different? That's the key case here. So understand, Rav Moshe, why is a fetus different? So we saw last week, and I'll show you again, you can kill a fetus because a fetus is not actually alive to the same degree. Look at Rashi number 8. Says, the kol zman shelo yatzel ha'aver, if the fetus has not come into the world, yavir ha'olam, lav nefesh hu, then even though normally you can't say this blood is redder than this blood, there are exceptional situations where you can. It's not about quality of life in the classic sense. What kind of a life does this person have? It's about the nature of the life. The nature of the life of a fetus is fundamentally less, and therefore you can kill the fetus. How does that relate to baby A and baby B, to the twins? So during the deliberations, one of the analogies which was raised was the following. Think of the following case. I'll stop the share for a second. Imagine two men jumped out of a burning plane, and one of them opened their parachute, and the other one, the parachute would not open. So as the second man was falling, he grabbed the legs of the first man in order to save himself, but was now pulling both of them down for certain death. Is the first man who has an open parachute allowed to kick off the second man in order to save his own life? And the answer to that question, I can see you all nodding, the answer to that question is yes. Why? Why so? Because the second man, halachically, is a roidef. What is a roidef? A roidef is someone who is coming to kill another, and the halacha is, we kill the roidef in order to save the person that they are trying to kill. Now, is a roidef's life worth less than the person they're pursuing? Apparently so. Here we have another case where somebody's blood is quote-unquote less red than somebody else's. What if the roidef is innocent in this particular case? It doesn't matter. It seems, and we'll see the Gemara now, I never showed you this last week, but we'll see right now, it seems that even an innocent roidef, I mentioned this last week, is still a roidef. Look at number 9, please. Gemara in Sanhedrin. Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, Katan haroidef. What if a child is innocently about to kill somebody? Nitan hatzilo banasho, are we allowed to save the victim by killing the child? So the Gemara says, basically, yes. And then the Gemara asks, Eifer Rav Chizkiya Rav Huna, one second, what about the fetus? Yatza Rosho, or the half-born child, Yatza Rosho ein noigim bo. We just said in the Mishnah, if the fetus has emerged, you may not kill it to save the mother. The fisha ein dochi nefesh b'tnei nefesh. Zahamai, why not? Roidef hu, why is that fetus not also a roidef? So the emerging, born child, not the fetus in the utero, but the born child, the half-born child, who is stuck in delivery. Why is he not a roidef? Says the Gemara, and these are the key words, Shani Hassan, it's different there, the Mishamaya Karatile, because it's not the fetus making a choice, the baby is not making a choice, heaven, if you like, is pursuing this mother and causing this issue. And if you look in the Yerushalmi, which again we never saw last week, the way the Yerushalmi phrases it, look at the end phrase here, number 10, says, Shani Yahitman, this is a different case with the born baby, She'ein ata yodea mi horeg et mi. It's not clear which one is killing which one. So let's apply this analogy. In the case of a baby being born, where the baby is, I got a little internet glitch, hopefully you can still see me, you can still hear me and see me, yes? Thumbs up? Yes, good. In the case of the baby being born, the mother is actively killing the baby, unintentionally, and the baby is killing the mother. Which one is killing which one? We don't know which one is killing which one, and therefore you cannot intervene. In the case of the parachute, we know who is the killer. It's innocent and it's understandable, but we know who the killer is. It's the person who is pulling the legs of the one who has an open parachute. Clearly, in that case, we can identify who is the real Roedef. Will the real Roedef please stand up? So Rav Moshe Feinstein applied, according to Rabbi Tendler, applied this analogy as follows. And he said, in this case of the babies, it's not the same as two people trying to kill each other. There is a clear victim and a clear innocent, but nevertheless clear aggressor. Have a look in Rav Tendler's own language, number 11 here. Rav Tendler writes this up. While in the uterine environment, the child is totally dependent on the mother's life forces. Thus, either the mother's death or the fetus's death would result in a fetus that's not viable. The fetus is going to die if the mother dies, for sure. This complete dependency on the mother, so that if the mother dies, the fetus will also die, is the reason given for the mother's priority over the fetus, because she is the source of the fetal life. The mother is more alive, the fetus is totally dependent on her. Once the head appears, however, and the child is able to breathe independently, he's treated as an entity separate from the mother. He's now independent of the mother's circulatory and respiratory systems. So we can't kill them. Rav Feinstein compared the case of the Siamese twins to this classic case for the conflict for survival between a mother in childbirth and a fetus. Baby A had no independent ability to survive. Her entire survival was completely dependent on her sister, who had a circulatory system to back up the functioning of the heart and liver. To Rav Feinstein's critical question, can the heart be given to baby A and she would live? Dr. Koop responded, no. There is no way to save baby A. The issue is only should both die or should baby B be saved. Without the attempted separation, both would surely die, and therefore in halachic terminology, key quote coming up, we classify a baby that has no independent survival, baby A, as the pursuer, as the roeder, as if she were pursuing her sister and threatening her life. Further sophisticated testing has determined the halakhic concept of dependency was indeed the relationship between the twins, and he goes on to describe it. So according to Rabbi Tendler, the reason that Rav Moshe Feinstein allowed killing baby A is because baby A was clearly a roedef. She was clearly attacking the other one, of course innocently, unintentionally, but unlike the case in the Gemara where the baby is half born and we really can't tell who is attacking whom, in this case, we could clearly tell, and therefore Rav Moshe gave the psak to kill baby A. Okay, that's Rav Tendler's analysis. Rabbi J. David Bleich writes up this case in another place. I brought you all the sources, and he disagrees. He says, it's not clear how you can even say that, because how do you know who owns the heart? How can you say that baby B owns the heart, and baby A is a parasite? Maybe baby A and baby B co-own the heart together. He said, in order to Rav Moshe to allow baby A to be killed and its own blood supply to be cut off from its own heart, potentially, you have to come on to another level of analysis. So Rabbi Bleich says you have to take it a stage further. And this is what he says. Rabbi Bleich says you have to look at the case of Sheva ben Bichri, which we looked at briefly last time, and you have to look at the issue of when are you allowed to kill one living person to save another group of people, potentially. And it's related to Roedef, it's part of the idea of Roedef, but it takes it one stage further. So it's a bit complicated, let's focus on this and understand what Rabbi Bleich says. Basically, let's have a look at the Gemara number 12. It's a Tosefta. Siyashel bnei Adam, if there was a group of people, She'amru lahem goyim, and terrorists came up to them and said to them, Snu lanu echad mikem, give us one person, v'nargenu, because we're going to kill that person and save you. V'im lav, and if you don't hand him over, hari anu horgim et kulchem, we're going to kill you. Your life versus his life. A group versus an individual. One will live, one will die. Says the Tosefta, Yargu, Yaregu, they have to be killed. Kulam, all of them. They may not hand over a Jewish life, even to save a whole group of Jewish lives. Aval, here's the key. Im yachduhu lahem. If they say, we want this guy, to go and sheyichdu l'sheva ben Bichri, as in the case of Sheva ben Bichri, who was the renegade against David, we looked at that last week. Yitnu lahem, then they can give over the man. Va'al yargu kulam. And they don't all have to die. If they specify, they can hand him over. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, the Madvar, I mean, what is the reason, where does this apply? Bizman, Shehu, Bifnim, Vehem, Bidachutz. The only question is if they're in one place and he's in the other. It's their lives versus the group versus the individual. Aval bizman shehu bitnin v'heim bitnin. But if they're all together, hoyel v'hu nerag v'heim nerag. And since they're all going to die anyway, definitely if nu lehem va'al yagu kolam, they can definitely hand him over. If they're all going to die, then what's the shaila? They're all going to die anyway. This individual will die in any event. They can certainly hand him over. Rav Shimon says no. Kach amar lehen. This is what the woman said in the story of Sheva Mikri. Kol hamorid b'malchus beisavid chayiv misa. You have to be guilty. Rabbi Shimon comes along and says you can only hand, even if they're all going to die, you can only hand someone over if they are objectively liable to death. They are guilty of a capital crime like Sheva ben Bichri. So again, let's clarify what's going on here. You have a debate. Can you hand one person over to save the many? And there are basically two views. One view says, well, if they're all going to die, then yes, you can hand him over. And the other view says, no, even if they're all going to die, the one you hand over has to be guilty in some way. Okay, how do we paskin? What is the halacha? Look in number 13. The Yerushalmi picks this up and says, we never saw this last week. Tani. Sayyid ben Adam, this case, a group of people, Shehayim, Ahalfi, Maderich, Pagolahem, Goyim, and terrorists attack them in the road. For Amru, and they say, Tnulano Echad Mekem, Venarogata, we'll kill that person. Say, Imlav, Hari, Anu Horgim, Et Kulchem, and if not, we're going to kill you all. So the Gemara Yerushalmi says, "Afidu kolam ne'eragim, even if they're all going to die, lo yimsru nefesh echad miyisrael." Okay, yichtu lahem, but once they specify him, echad especially yichtu le'echad, kugan sheva ben bichri, yimasru otam ma'al yaregu. Okay, fine. So that's one view. If they're all going to die and there's a specified person, you can hand him over. Amar Reb Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish says no. He follows the opinion of Reb Shimon that we saw before. That's only if the guy's guilty to Sheva ben Bichri. Rabbi Yochanan says no. You have a debate. Does the person you hand over have to be guilty objectively or not guilty? So fascinatingly, this is a debate in the Gemara which never fully finds resolution. Sometimes we see this. It's a debate within the Gemara. It's a debate within the Rishonim. I brought you the views here. Rashi brings both views. The Me'iri, the Ran, and others go like Rabbi Yochanan. He doesn't have to be liable to death to hand him over. The Rambam view goes like Reish Lakish. He does have to be liable to death. And even the Shulchan Aruch, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, these are practical cases, brings both views. Some say that he does have to be guilty. Some say that he doesn't have to be guilty. Now, what has this got to do with our case of the twins? Let's take it back to the twins. In the case of the twins, is anybody guilty? Guilty of the liable to the death penalty. Forget about a roidef. Is anybody guilty? No. Nobody is guilty. Nobody is guilty at all. The baby is clearly innocent, not like Sheva ben Bichri. But is anybody designated? Is in some way one of these twins separated out, halachically, as being the one to be handed over? So there you can make a case. And you can say, given the critical difference in health between the two twins, one of them is designated to be handed over, as it were, baby A, and the other one is not baby B. So if we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, like those views that say you don't have to be guilty, so maybe we could use this as an argument. Says Rabbi Bleich, the problem is we don't know how we paskin. Look at number 15. In light of the unresolved controversy between early day authorities with regards to the matter, a rabbinic decisor would find grave difficulty in sanctioning an overt act designed to extinguish the life of one twin on the basis of this consideration alone. Meaning, we're not certain enough about the halacha to be able to say you can hand over one of these twins because they're designated, because maybe the halacha requires the twin handed over, the person handed over, to be actually liable and actually guilty. So that won't help us. So what helps Rav Moshe? So let me tell you, Rabbi Bleich comes along and says, this is a genius answer. The way that Rav Moshe understood the sugi was as follows. How do I know which one to hand over to save which other one? Okay? In the case of a group versus an individual, we may not hand over an individual who's not designated specifically to save the group. Because who can tell? Why is one life worth more or less than 100 lives, 1,000 lives, 1,000,000 lives? Life is infinite. However, says Rav Moshe, when one of them is designated, and they will die anyway, then they are quote-unquote less alive than the rest of the group. Think about this. The rest of the group are faced with death. This individual is faced with double death. Either they hand him over, and he dies, or they don't hand him over, and he dies anyway. Says Rav Moshe, you have two people, again, chasing each other, who have different statuses. One is a bigger roedif on the other than the other. In the case of Reish Lakish, the case of Sheva ben Bichri, he is, if you like, triply dead. That even if they hand him over, and they don't kill him when they hand him over, he's liable to go to court anyway and be killed. So Rabbi Bleich explains the following, that Rav Moshe Feinstein allowed baby A to be killed, not just because she was a roedif, but because we have this situation here of Chayei Shah versus a longer life, a shorter life versus a longer life. Baby A has far less likelihood of longer term life than baby B, and therefore you have a much less even scenario, and you are able to hand over, even according to Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, even according to the view that says one has to be guilty, all that means is they have to be much less quote-unquote alive. It's a bit complicated, but that's the way that Rabbi Bleich understands Rav Moshe. It's subtly but importantly different from Rav Tendler. Again, what did Rav Tendler say? Rav Tendler said one is a bigger roedif than the other. Rav Bleich says no, one is less alive in one sense. Their long-term lifespan is much less, which allows us, according to those Gemaras, to hand over one in order to save the masses. Okay, brief question. Why don't we just use the case of the two men walking in the desert? Remember the Gemara in Bava Metzia? I brought it on your sheet. Two guys walking in the desert, one has a bottle of water. Okay? If they both drink it, you know the case. If they both drink it, both will die. And if the person who owns the water drinks it, then he'll survive, but the other one will die. So what do we pass him? Is he allowed to drink the water, or do they share it and both die? What does he do? He drinks the water. Everybody knows that, right? He drinks the water. So why don't we just turn around and say, so what's all the complicated analysis about? Baby B has the water. She has the heart. She has the health. She can drink it. She can keep it, even if baby A dies. Why don't we just apply that? So the answer is, because it's not the same as the desert case. In the desert case, the person with the water is allowed to drink it. In our case, there are two critical differences. Number one, it's not the person making the decision. It's someone standing outside making the decision. The doctors, the rabbis. So let's say we're back in the desert case. Let's say there are two guys, and neither of them has water. But I have water. And I can decide, am I going to give to this one, or am I going to give to that one? So that's a different case. That's not the case of the Gemara. That's the case of the twins, though. And also, critically, in the case of the twins, we're not talking about drinking water and passively causing the other one to die. We're talking about actively killing one to save the other. Hopefully you can see how the case of the two guys walking in the desert is really not going to help us, because here we're not just allowing one to die, we're actually actively killing them. So whichever reason is the reason that Rav Moshe Paskin to kill baby A, that is what they did. What was the result? So sadly the result was not a happy ending, because they sacrificed baby A, and indeed the operation went very well, and baby B survived the operation, did not have the complications that they expected. However, tragically, a few weeks later, baby B died due to a completely unrelated situation, that he died from complications from hepatitis B, from a blood transfusion that the baby needed. So neither of the babies actually survived. Had these babies survived, they would now be in their 40s, which is interesting. But nevertheless, the debate that grew out of this case became part of the folklore, if you like, of halacha. It's extremely well discussed, but as you hopefully have been able to see, the subtleties as to why Rav Moshe Feinstein decided the way he did, whether it was because of Rav Moshe Tendler's understanding that one was a bigger roedif than the other, okay, and therefore it was like a fetus that was affecting the mother. That's why we could kill the parasitic twin in order to save the other. They weren't equal. Or whether it was like the argument of Rav Bleich, who says, no, it wasn't just because of the roedif. One was intrinsically less long-term alive than the other. And in that case, we saw you're allowed to hand over somebody who is more dead, doubly dead, triply dead, as it were, to save people who are quote-unquote less dead. Either way, that's what they decided. You should know, this was not agreed on by everybody. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky at the time objected, and he said he didn't think it was permitted in order to kill the twin in order to save the other, and you can look on the sheet where I've written the basis on which Rabbi Kamenetsky possibly disagreed. Did he feel that the fetus case was not comparable? Whatever, you can look at that in your own time. But that was the famous case of the conjoined twins. This will become less and less of an issue as medical technology allows us to separate the twins. But if you ever do have a conjoined twin come to your minion and ask that I want to be counted as two, then that's actually a very good shaila. I don't suggest you pour any boiling water over anybody's head, because that clearly would be halachically highly problematic. But you need to have someone online who can answer this shaila. It sounds to me that if you had conjoined twins like the Bunker twins, who were clearly two people joined at the chest, then why would they not count as two people? They should surely count as two people. Even if they had one body and two heads, which is a bit that's answering to Kaddish, presumably the heads rather than the legs. Anyway, I'm not getting into that. I'm not a post-sec. You can take that up with your local Orthodox rabbi if it becomes relevant, and so too with the inheritance case. But hopefully, Baruch Hashem, we worked out the technical issues. We didn't have any more glitches. Baruch Hashem. I'm sorry you heard my computer go ding every now and then during the shir. I had to leave that on in case we all collapsed and I needed to speak to David to bring us back to life. But we didn't need Tchiyas HaMeisim. We managed without it. If anyone has any questions, or if anybody wants the sheet, or if anybody has any observations, please by all means get in touch with me. We have finished now our discussion on these fetal and conjoined twin issues. Next week, a little bit of a prior notice. I want to speak about kashrus issues. We talked about that. But for the 3 weeks, next week is Sheva Asa B'Tammuz. Therefore, for the period of the 3 weeks, I want to refocus us just for a little while on a topic we have not looked at for 5 years, okay, which is issues of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And I want to look at three very important paradoxes within Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, and look at the halachic and hashkafic implications, because I think at this time of year we need to focus on the interpersonal mitzvahs specifically as we move up to Tishu or Tisha B'Av. Therefore, I'd like to do that with you for the next 3 weeks, and then we can get back to our other issues. So for now, I wish you all a good week, a healthy week. Thank you all for coming on again, especially to my mum and dad and to my in-laws, and I hope that you all have a great week, and I look forward to seeing you next time. Have a good time. All the best.